This episode is presented by Shaxbury Cider.
This week on Meat and Three, we bring you stories about the coldest, darkest season. We start in a California vineyard.
It's cold, but it's wet, and things are still alive. There's a lot of life in this soil.
We explore two frontiers of cocktail culture, luxury ice and the rise of non-alcoholic drinks.
The rocks traditionally becomes 25% of your drink's volume, and as such, it imparts smells and tastes.
And we investigate the risks facing New York City delivery workers during the harsh winter.
In the wintertime, after 2 hours of biking, it's quite easy, actually, for the bikes to sting upside down or slips or slide.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, for some food for thought to sustain you through the dead of winter. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today I'm speaking with David Sanchez Carpio from the Food and Water Watch in España. David, thank you so much for joining me today. We were having a fascinating conversation, which really I should have recorded for everybody. As soon as you came in, we were like, you know, go off to the races. But tell me a few things. Let's start with how has the pork industry changed in Spain in the last two decades? You've been doing this work for about 10, 15 years, right?
Yeah.
So what are the major changes that you've seen? And you were just telling me now off the tape that that the way Spain has ramped up has really been problematic. So give me a thumbnail of how it's changed.
Okay. Well, first, pleasure to be here with you. In Spain, we have a traditional way of doing pig farming, no? Mainly in the west of Spain, where pigs are living in forest, outdoors, and they are being fed out of nuts, no? And that they would find naturally in the forest.
Right, acorns, hickory nuts.
Yeah. So that's like the Iberian ham, no? That is quite a symbol, no, of Spanish food tradition.
Most definitely.
What we have found is that big industry has been using Spain to run a factory farming model to produce pork meat, cheap one, not this same breed of pig that was the traditional one, focusing on exports. Around Europe, factory farming started in Northern Europe, but now in countries like Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, they are really implementing now environmental legislation, like about nitrogen pollution and other kinds of problems associated with factory farming. So industry is focusing to Spain, into Spain and other Eastern European countries, like places where they can still pollute and reduce the price of the meat they're trying to export, mainly to China, for example, now.
So China is your biggest customer?
Now, I think the big push that we've seen in the last 5-6 years is mainly export to China. Chinese market is growing, no? It's expanding meat consumption, and they are looking for the cheapest place to produce their meat. And now it seems to be Spain.
Have they done what they did in the United States, which was they bought an enormous company called Smithfield? I'm sure you're aware of that, which included 400 farms, 26 or 28 processing plants, and then all these other sort of added value chains that went along with that. And it was one of the largest industrial purchases. I think they bought it for about $4.5 billion, actually. Mm-hmm. And so they took over that whole sector of the pork industry. Have they been buying up pork farms in Spain, or they just contract with?
Not so far. I mean, we had Smithfield here for a long time.
You had Smithfield here.
Yeah, because they bought one of the biggest pork meat industries, Campo Frío.
Ah.
But now they belong to a Mexican group, the Alfa Group. So Carlos Slim and all these billionaires, no? so far, the Spanish meat industry is still mainly family-owned. So they are like families from Catalonia or in the south, Murcia or Galicia, that are running the business. That is really, it's a really efficient industry because it's vertically integrated. Since the 60s, they have been doing this.
Mm-hmm.
with these farmer cooperatives at the beginning. Then it was the feed industry. Then it was supermarkets, no? Like the main supermarkets. They're also really vertically integrated to produce their
I was
meat.
Very curious about that because that doesn't exist in the States. The supermarkets are a whole different, you know, buying collective, I think. But here you're saying that the Spanish supermarket chains actually own their own farms or own their own companies that produce pork for their chain. Well, what's the average size of a supermarket chain here?
Oh, you mean as an industry?
Well, like say, I know Carrefour is a French company, but you do have it here. So in Spain, how many of them are there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Carrefour is one of the biggest in Spain as well.
Yeah.
Then we have a Spanish one that is called Mercadona.
Right.
And Mercadona is one of these, it's a bit of a unique model of supermarket because they try to promote good salary conditions for workers. They try to buy Spanish products. And what they do is that they associate themselves with companies producing their food. And one of their companies is called Incarlopsa, and is the one that is promoting factory farming in the southeast of Spain, and is signing also agreements to sell to China. So it's not directly the supermarket, but it's this company associated with the supermarket. So Incarlopsa is a great example because what they did was to build a huge slaughterhouse, not far from Madrid, of course. All this is to feed big cities, no? Yep. Centers of consumption. In Tarancón is the name of the place, and because they can kill, I don't know how many thousands of pigs in the same day, they are looking for areas all around to build factory farms. So a region that is called Castilla-La Mancha is the place of Don Quixote, no? Sí. And it's like a quite mythical area of Spain, is revolting against this because they want to build farms everywhere. No, and suddenly quiet villages, most of them, they were trying to look for another alternative for development, like tourism or, promoting that, the values of living in the countryside, no, like nature, contact with nature. Suddenly,
or even traditional products that are produced in the area, right?
Yeah, as well. So now they are facing a huge wave of factory farm projects that are coming to every village, no. And when they are rejected in one village, they go to the village next to it. So it's an ongoing process. The good side of it, and I guess we're going to talk about this, is how people are mobilizing against this and how they are managing to stop a lot of projects, how they are coordinating at the local scale, but also at the regional scale, to resist this industry. So the capital of this region, that is Toledo, because this industry is heavily promoted by the regional authorities, they go there every month. There is a big demonstration of all the people from these rural areas to go to Toledo and bring their problems there. No, so it's a great example of organizing that they are doing, and they are getting quite good results. No, resisting some of the worst projects. No, that have been planned.
Right. In other words, meaning some of the largest projects, the biggest CAFOs or the biggest slaughterhouses. you mentioned before we started the tape, you talked about a story about going to visit with a bunch of other NGOs. You went to visit a small town in an area that's experiencing a lot of pressure from industrialized farming. And I wanted you to recapitulate that story because I thought it just perfectly encapsulated the issues that make it so hard to deny an industry entrance into a town that is otherwise very low on resources. So can you just describe your experience with that mayor?
Yeah, sure. So we went to visit one small village in northeast Spain, in the province of Soria. It's called Noviercas. And Noviercas is a village of 150 people living there. It's really small in a quite non-populated area, no? And there's a farmers cooperative, actually, that want to build there a factory farm, a dairy factory farm with more than 20,000 cows.
Wow.
And that will be the biggest factory farm, dairy factory farm in Europe.
Yeah.
So it will be the first step to import to Europe this model coming from the US, no, of a huge dairy factory farm that we see in California, in other areas. No?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, well, we asked for a meeting with the mayor, and together with some other colleagues, no, from Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, also from farmer unions, we went to meet the mayor. And, I mean, when you talk with him, I mean, you can really understand his position at some point, no? They see this opportunity as the last chance to develop the area and the village. No, it's... I mean, they are losing population for the last 40 years, yeah. And these villages might disappear, no, if there is no alternative, no, to create jobs or to fix a population. But on the other hand, I mean, it's we thought it was really important to discuss with him about what can be the consequences, no, on the rural areas, learning from the experience from the U.S., for example, no, that is not going to create wealth in the area. It's going to create huge environmental problems, and at the end, the village is not going to find its miracle solution. It's also difficult to challenge this idea of somebody from outside needs to come here to develop this village. No, well, I mean, they have a lot of capacity and they have a lot of resources to create another model of jobs or development. No, I mean, this area of Soria is known because it's the nature is amazing,
really,
and they produce a lot of organic products or natural products, and although it has been really abandoned by public authorities, and they really need a development plan for the area. I mean, you can understand that you, as a mayor of a village that might disappear in 20 years if nothing happens, might welcome with open arms a developer that is offering to invest 100 million euros in your area, no?
Yeah.
And when you read about the potential impacts, you might look to the other side, no? Because, I mean, and this is really human. And if you, I mean, you go there and you imagine how hard it is to live there. And I mean, you can really feel empathy, no, for this kind of thinking. But well, I mean, we didn't manage to convince him yet. But at least I think it was really interesting to have an honest interchange on why we are trying to oppose this. It's not just big NGOs, no. It's also people living in the area that are trying to do another kind of farming. And opposing a project like this in such a tiny village, I mean, from a social point of view, is super complicated, no?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's creating enemies all around, because half of the village is going to sell their land to the company, a land that was, was worthless from the market point of view.
Right.
That is going to pay a fortune for this. Also to a lot of people that is no longer living in the village, no, that is living in the capital or whatever. So opposing this project, because you're a farmer there and you don't want to have this mega factory farm next to you, it's super difficult. But so what we're trying also to support, no, these efforts of building local resistance there, although it's a really difficult context, no, to promote, to advocate for another ways of development, no?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop right now, and we'll be right back with David Sanchez Carpio from the Food and Water Watch in España.
This episode is brought to you by Shaxbury Cider, who believe cider can be daring, complex, and eminently drinkable. Located in Vergennes, Vermont, Shaxbury make a broad offering of ciders, from the bright and fruity rosé to inventive small-batch wild apple fermentation. Each fall, Shaxbury takes to the hills of Vermont to forage for the wild and forgotten fruit that make up their Lost Apple Project. Shaxbury, producer of the first American-made Pet Nat cider, continues to experiment every year with limited-edition ciders designed to spotlight locally foraged fruit. To learn more, visit Shaxbury.com or follow them on Instagram at Shaxbury.
I want to talk more about, what you were just finishing up with a second ago, about sort of how you are helping communities build resistance, because it is a very complicated issue that does require both a lot of tact and also a lot of real world thinking in terms of how if you're not going to accept the miracle short term, but still miracle bullet of cash infusion from a big industrial player, then what are the alternatives for a community like that? So how do you guys help to support the activists who are engaged in trying to keep this at arm's length?
I mean, what we have been trying from Food and Water Watch here in Europe is to try to work with local communities, building capacity and trying to make the links between different communities resisting these projects. We were feeling that this was starting to be an emerging problem, but in really isolated areas. And for people, it was just about local problems. So there was an amazing community in the north next to the border with France that were mobilizing a lot against this industry, but they were not connecting so much with people in other regions that were fighting the same industry, no? So we published a report to give an overview. So this was not just about a problem in your village. This is happening everywhere. So these people are fighting the same industry from different places. We try to break this feeling of isolation that sometimes you have in rural areas, no? That you are just by yourself in your small region fighting this. No, I mean, you have many other people with whom you can build connections that can give you ideas, that can, that you can build on their successes and then their failures, no? So break this idea and build a movement. And also, trying to build a bit of capacity by learning from each other, no? Like those people in that community, it's called Lo Porzano. It's like the, they're one of the most active communities. They are super good with communications and social media, so that they can organize a workshop for other communities on how they can communicate, which kind of messaging has been more useful for them, working with media. Like in the sense of it's clear that we are not attacking farmers or farming. Our enemy is the industry, not the people that are desperate enough to accept these kind of deals. No, so building a movement and a common framework on how we're not just resisting a local specific project. It's going beyond a bit this not in my backyard movement, no? Because we are fighting a whole model of the meat industry that if it's maybe you can defeat and this factory farm in your village, but the industry is going to move to the village next to you.
Sure.
And the impacts are going still to be the same. So trying to build solidarity. We started organizing national gatherings, national meetings of impacted communities by factory farming. The first one in this village in Lo Porzano, and the second one in Cuenca, that is this La Mancha, no? This region that we were mentioning about in Carlopsa and this, and this industry. And I think it has been really successful to encourage people, learn from each other, build capacity. And now we have, I think it's one of the most dynamic movements in Spain now. It's a movement coming from rural areas that, as we were talking before, we tend to think that it's conservative areas, that people doesn't mobilize because it's quite a normally old population living there. But in villages of 200 people, they have been mobilizing a lot. They have been organizing demonstrations. They have been organizing campaigns. People are recording videos for YouTube in which they are singing and doing flash mobs in the villages, going to the capital to bring these problems from rural areas into where political decisions are taken. It's proving that people can get really organized, self-organized,
that grassroots works,
and they are being really successful at blocking some of the most damaging projects. No?
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me to a question that I wanted, I was very curious about, which is how much does your government, your national government, support the rise of factory farming in your country? Like, how much do they subsidize it? Do they give them special permissions? Is there a lot of lobbying going on from industrial players to sway legislators to find in their favor when it comes to any kind of regulations? Like, how much do you, what are you fighting against? Are you fighting against just the industrial guys, or are you fighting also against your own government?
Mm. I mean, I think we're fighting a monster because, well, I mean, meat industry is the fourth most important industry in Spain.
Yeah.
And we started fighting the growth of this industry in times of economic crisis. So it's attacking one of the few industries that is delivering from the economic point of view and that is working to for the trade balance. And so it's really difficult. The lobby, the meat lobby is super powerful in Spain.
Yes.
Because, I mean, they're a huge industry. This industry has a lot of subsidies that are difficult to trace because here in Europe we have the Common Agricultural Policy that is similar to the Farm Bill.
Yeah.
But here we don't have a definition for a factory farm. This CAFO, no, this concentrated animal feeding operations that you have a definition in the US, we don't have anything similar in Europe.
Really?
We're trying to introduce it in the next reform of this Common Agricultural Policy. But it's difficult to trace which subsidies go to which kind of farm.
Mm.
Also, we have been, I mean, like in the US, for many years, we had like a agricultural policy that was focusing on trade, no, on international trade, in right. which all the subsidies are linked to scaling up the farms. I mean, if you want to become a livestock farmer, you are not going to get subsidies if you only have 20 cows. No, I mean, the minimum amount, I don't know exactly, but it can be 200. No, so it's like they are promoting a competitive, no, in their sense, no,
yes.
a model of livestock farming. So for many years they have been promoting this model, no, through subsidies, through really bad policies, and also because of all these free trade agreements that they are signing, no, because for example the European Union is negotiating one free trade agreement for many time with Mercosur, so Argentina, Brazil. Some countries that are the most like the ones that are producing more meat, no, and exporting more meat. So for a long time, what European politicians wanted is that European farmers got competitive with Mercosur, no. When we know this is never going to happen, no. I mean the
no.
the model, I mean the farming.
You're never going to be JBS.
No, and absolutely, but also because in Europe we have a big conscience of which is our model of farming, no, and the model of farming that we want. We have a clear idea of, we are proud of our landscape and our heritage, no, I mean, it depends on the country, no, Europe is super diverse, but I mean, we have a lot of history, no, and they're coming from rural areas, so we are really proud of our products, no, like this Spanish ham or chorizo or all the cheese in France, no, so
right.
there is some connection, some cultural connection with our family farming model, and it doesn't work, this kind of huge factory farms, only in desperate areas, no, where they don't see any other way of development, no, and industry is making use of it, no, it's taking advantage of people that are a bit desperate, looking for alternatives, no, economic alternatives for their villages.
Wow.
So yeah, we are fighting big industry and also a lot of governmental support, especially from regions. For factory farming, it's mainly regional legislation because they are dealing with environment. And what we see is that in many regions they are just making things as easy as possible for industry because it's employment in rural areas. No,
right.
And this is like a mantra that although we know that you're not creating real, like, good quality employment or even employment with these factory farms, politicians are going to use this mantra to justify their support for industry.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's just that they pay that much more taxes, that increases the tax base. I know that's a big argument in the United States, that these industries, you know, contribute to the tax base and that helps pay for, you know, whatever, schools and roads and da-da-da-da-da in rural areas.
It's not an argument that we hear in Spain, no.
Huh. No, I'm wrong.
It depends on the area you're using an argument. But it's mainly employment. It's about fixing population.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a real problem of how we balance population in Spain, no, with most of the people living in Madrid, that is just in the center of the country, and then like a huge empty donut, no? And then people living in the coast.
Oh, yeah.
So this is starting to be a political debate, and because it's a real problem. No, then we have fires in forests because nobody's taking care of them. I mean, we all come from rural areas somehow, no? Our parents or grandparents. And when you go there, I mean, they are completely, most of them are abandoned by administration, no? So this is, or in the public debate, so their main argument is about fixing population and employment.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we know that, I mean, you create one employment for every 4,000 or 5,000 peaks. So it's,
pretty much.
And all the problems that you're creating and all the other alternatives that you're killing because you are promoting this model. We have interesting conflicts, there is an area next to Madrid called Segovia that is an area where they are promoting a lot tourism in rural areas.
Yeah.
And they have been forced to pass a legislation in which factory farms cannot spread manure in weekends, during weekends and bank holidays. So it doesn't interfere with tourism.
Sure.
But still, that means that okay, if you're living there, you get,
5 days a week, you're smelling big shit.
Yeah. So your life is horrible, but we want to protect tourism. And when people from Madrid are going there for the weekends, they cannot smell like manure, no? So it's I mean, it's creating a lot of conflicts in rural areas as well between different models of how you want to develop economy and create jobs in the rural areas.
Yeah, we have our problems are so similar in the States. I guess they are everywhere, but it's the same thing. We have, you know, tremendous flight to urban areas, a lot of loss of farming, people who want to farm anymore. What's your average age of farmer here, just out of curiosity? Ours, in the States, it's somewhere between 54 and 58 years old.
It should be 58, 60, something
yeah.
like that.
So yeah. Not a lot of people in Spain are going back into farming.
No, because, well, I mean, for many reasons, but they're not making it easy to have to become a farmer the way you want to be a farmer. It's difficult to have access to land. I mean, it's a whole process. And also, I mean, it's this image of if you're living in rural areas that your parents are, most of them are going to try that you study at university and never come back. No,
it's yeah.
I mean, we are still in this process of people feel that they need to leave rural areas because there is no future there.
Yeah.
Well, that is true for some regions, not this mentality, but in some other regions, I mean, there's a thriving economy going there based on the organic farmer, local markets, or tourism, no? But we still have this dilemma, no? So we have a problem with renewing the farmers in Spain and all around Europe.
Certainly all around the United States. And that's one argument why industrial farmers or industrial farming companies use that to say, well, we produce so much food with so little labor, you know, there's really no way to push back against that. I mean, people don't want to farm anymore. Well, people don't want to farm, I think, A, because it's really hard work and we're not used to that anymore, but also because it is so hard to compete against the prices. And I wanted, that just brings me to sort of the end, I think what should be the end of the interview, but in the United States, factory industrialized meat production has essentially crushed the people who are producing it, either through the contract farming model that we use for pigs and chickens, which I'm going to give you a copy of my book and you'll learn all about that.
Thank you.
and the cattle production, where the processor is the one who determines the price of the product at the end. And so because they are able to work on such a big scale, they can squeeze those farmers and make them, you know, accept lower and lower prices in order to stay in the game. Because if you're raising 20,000 birds or 50,000 pigs, you don't have an option about where to go when it comes time to bring those animals to slaughter. You cannot possibly process and distribute 20,000 or 50,000 carcasses. So they really do have you over a barrel as a farmer. And I wanted to ask you if that sort of was a problem here as well, where the few people who remain, you know, farming pigs in a sort of normal way, like say with 100 pigs or 250 pigs, do they find that their prices are being squeezed by these big companies? Like, how does that work for you guys?
Yeah, I think it has been the same situation
really
for the last decades, in which all the like small farms are disappearing because they cannot compete for prices. With this model of distribution in which supermarkets are now the main source of where you are going to buy food in cities.
Right.
I mean, with 200 pigs, you have no leverage, no way to negotiate with Mercadona, Carrefour, or these kind of producers. And also there you can feel the meat industry lobby, because legislation was made for the big meat industry. So there was no legislation regulating direct selling from farm to consumer or other ways of artisanal ways of processing. So in a moment in which for someone like a small slaughterhouse in a rural area, they have the same legislation that this huge slaughterhouse from in Carloxa that we were talking before. So if you have the same requirements, I mean, you cannot compete in a fair way, you know? So this is changing a lot, and some regions are trying to regulate farmers markets and adapting health and sanitary rules to be more realistic with family farming, no? And what a small-scale farming means. So on one hand, you had the pressure, the market pressure, and on the other hand, you have a legislation that was designed for big industry.
Right. And so you guys are changing that because the laws are being rewritten to give more leeway to smaller farmers? You feel like that's something that's happening? And is that something that the NGOs are working on?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that is happening. It's because, well, there's a European framework that you can adapt. And now some regions in Spain are adapting this regulation to make some space for small producers to survive and to make their living. No, and this is something that a lot of movements are working. In Spain, there is a big food sovereignty movement, like a lot of community-supported agriculture, no?
We have that.
A lot of groups that are working with farmer unions, looking for other ways of... for the people that want to do other models of farming, that can start becoming a farmer, and that they can market their products in the way they want, and not in the way subsidies and industry are trying to promote them to market their products. And this is difficult for them, but I think that for most small-scale farmers and for consumers, it's obvious that we need to work together to create another food system, no? And this movement is growing in Spain, in a country that we come from. We have been a developed country not for so long, so changing this food mentality, it's a bit difficult. But, it's creating a lot of links and a lot of connection between farmers and urban consumers in the way to promote this kind of other market alternatives.
Mm.
So this is... that brings a lot of hope, no? On how we can try to change the food system in Spain.
And yet your food is so much better here already than it is in the States. I just can't get over, the markets. But I also, and I'll wrap it up here, but when I have two local markets here. I have Mercado de Cebada, and I have Mercado San Fernando.
Yeah.
And these are two huge buildings. That obviously were once packed to the rafters with vendors and which are now by and large empty, like tragically empty. I mean, really quite sad to me to see. And I see that there's a supermercado or a mini super on every block practically in this neighborhood anyway. And so I see the damage that the supermarket industry is doing to those traditional markets. But are those guys in the traditional type of marketplace like the Mercado de Cebada, are those more farm-to-table type vendors? Or they're buying from the same big, giant, like our Hunts Point market in New York City, for example, where all of the big distributors come in with their stuff? Yes, you're nodding. Yeah. Yes, it's the same.
Yeah, it's a bit the same model. for us, the markets in the Mediterranean area are a super important place where you meet people.
Like a social. They're very place. Social. Yeah. Yes, and there's places to drink and hang out with your friends and kids.
And also because it's like a personal contact in which the guy is selling you the fruit, you know him, he knows the way how you like bananas, and so you have this this direct interaction that you will never have in a supermarket.
Right.
But at some point Spain was developing. We were all super impressed by supermarkets, and those places started to be a bit abandoned. I think that now, they are reviving a lot, also because we have a strong culture of buying fresh products,
fruit, every day.
Fish, there's a common understanding that you won't find it in the supermarkets, in the proper way. But still, most of these people selling these markets is not direct selling. It comes from this central processor. It's called Mercamadrid. That carries many of the problems that supermarkets are. No, it's basically the same model. But one of the markets that you mentioned is being taken over by other alternatives, no, especially from the neighborhood, no, like
Cebada,
San Fernando.
Oh, San Fernando.
San Fernando, in which also they try to mix the way they tried the local council of Madrid, that was super neoliberal for 20 years. For them, the way to make those spaces a living space was to sell one floor to a supermarket and then leave another one for market, no, because you understand that people are going to buy fruit in the market and then they're going to go to the supermarket. So there in San Fernando, the idea was to challenge that model. So you have a bookshop, for example, sells books by kilo. No? you have some bars that are kind of for you, like local drinks. Then you have an organic shop where you can buy organic vegetables, cheese. So it's trying to look for other alternatives, no? Community-based alternatives. And I think this is the way to go for these markets, because you need to offer... they offer this direct contact, no? Like being in touch with people, that for me it's important, but also like for elderly people, no? It's like feeling treated as a person. That is something that you would never get in a supermarket, no?
Right.
But also you need to differentiate your model, no? You cannot sell the same stuff that... the people upstairs in the supermarket are selling, because, you're always going to be more expensive than them.
Yeah.
No, you cannot compete. So you need to go to other model, no, like a more direct selling or working directly with farmers. And this is starting to happen, no. And for us, it's super important to keep these markets, because it's the center of a neighborhood, no.
Absolutely.
It's like a social life, and so it's a challenge. Resisting neoliberalism is a challenge, but. there are many alternatives popping up, so it's kind of encouraging.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing, and thank you so much for joining me today. David Sanchez Carpio from Food and Water Watch, I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot for this.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.